question.
If I just happen to see the
I didn't see the program on Stonehenge, but I read the clipping that announced in the Santa Ana newspaper that they were going to have a program on Stonehenge for about 2.5 hours. And they were going to talk about its purpose and its origin and all the things that relate to it. But I wasn't home here. I was away, and so I didn't see it. And they were going to try to figure out the answers, they said, to when it was built and who built it and so forth. But while not seeing the program, we know the answers as far as Stonehenge is concerned. Stonehenge was built by our Aryan ancestors, and it was built prior to the advent of Israel into the Isles. It was built by Aryans that had preceded them, and they had gone to this place at Avebury to build this because it was pretty well located from the site from where they wanted to be. We also had it Dolring over on the Persian Gulf, another Stonehenge like this. And up back of Burma in the Himalayas are Aryan forebears that went into India and gave them the highest order of civilization they ever had, sent their savants up into Thailand of Burma, and they set in the Himalayas another Stonehenge. Now these three sighting planes, like the pyramid, were set to measure not only the precession of equinoxes, but with it they could measure accurately the farthest areas of progression in the changing the positions of the moon and its changes over the cycles of years, which every 6 to 9 years there's alternation cycle. And they were so set, those stones were so perfectly set, that from the various positions they could get the exact measures of movement of in relationship to the planets in the solar system and their alignment. And they were watching and using this not only for a complete knowledge of the patterns and the dates for the equinox, but so they could, they were waiting for these various configurations in the heavens that they could start watching, one of which was the most important one, was the sign of the embodiment of God and the coming of Messiah. So this is why, and our race has had this from the days of Enoch, and even earlier they knew about some of these things, because remember that our Aryan forebears came down up out of that the high steps of the upper Tashan Mountains, the upper Tetum Basin. They came to the Persian Gulf, and then they migrated Persian Gulf, some of them down to the areas around Ur of the Chaldeans and the areas where Nimrod later set up his kingdom. They went over into India, and of course they brought the highest culture that India, which was already under pagan religions and fallen gods and Lucifer's control. But in fact, the history of India shows that during the Aryan invasion, they had their highest culture and their highest civilization. Of course, we set a caste system right up because they were inferior to us, and we would not permit our people to be destroyed by inferior society. And some of them were really untouchable. But the fact is that in setting up this caste system, we gave them the advantage of our knowledge and wisdom, but not the breaking down of our blood. But eventually, of course, there was some intermixing, which was the result, of course, of the Mughal invasions too, which overthrew, eventually outnumbered as we were so heavily. We were unable to hold the line completely. The Vedic writings and the areas where great spiritual truths are incorporated into what later is all messed up again in pagan Hinduism was brought in by our race during the time we were there. If you're a student of phrenology today, or if you study races by head shape and anatomy, you'll find that they were so many Aryans that controlled India. And some of this blood fused through India, and there's still pockets of Aryans there today, that they classify the Hindus as a Caucasian type, though not altogether for India. So when you see these Hindus, but they have the head shape of the Caucasian, and they classify them as Caucasian type, and the Encyclopedia Britannica, up until this present edition, used to mark them as the Caucasian type, though there are many non-Caucasians and non-whites there. They said they have this phrenology, and of course it comes from the heavy Aryan stock that came over and resided there. See, now, this goes back, these are the sons of the descendants of Seth in the household, up to about the same time that we come to Enoch and Job migrating, or their peoples migrating down out of the steppes too. Adam left Eden about 5400 B.C. About 5000 B.C., we have Enoch and Job on the panorama of history, and Enoch was writing the things that he had from his heavenly experience and his trips out into the heavens about 5000 B.C. So therefore, it was right close to this, and thereafter that he and Job led that group of 144,000 savants down into Egypt to build on, in which the eye of Yahweh and the great disc protected them from the dark priest of Set and Thoth that wanted to destroy these white men that were coming in. And after that, they didn't have much problem from there on. And Job and Enoch went down about that period of time. The writings of Enoch date back to around 5,000 to 4,800 B.C. in along that period of time. Now, remember that Stonehenge, the sighting factors of Stonehenge, Doe Ring, and the High Himalaya Ring of stones, all set together, all of them the product of white men coming in, show that this lore of measuring the sky, understanding the processions of equinoxes, and knowing the world was round, was specifically a white man's knowledge. And this is true, of course, in the Temple of Zendera, where we set up the signs of the equinox and all the patterns with it. And there again, the cycle shows that the movement of the planet and their revolutions, and the earth and its revolution. And so today, sitting in this temple, which white men built in Egypt, it's thoroughly known that they knew the world was round, they knew we made this orbit, and they knew the positions. And so here we have 612 stars from first to seventh magnitude that we could see with the eye, which we set in this visible temple. So this again is all of these 612 stars were, of course, could be sighted in the course of the night as we move in our positions. But the stars are always there. In other words, the stars never move. We shift north and south in our axis according to in our ecliptic as we from winter to summer. And in the summer we can see more stars or stars that we can't see in the wintertime sometimes because of the shift. But the fact is the stars, except for the slight motion, are always in the same place, in latitude and longitude. And it's only the planets that move. So we know that these Aryans that came into India came in and established this about the same time as the peoples that provided the parents for Enoch and Job had been making their migrations, and their migrations had been down to the areas around old Mesopotamia and over into what we know now as Palestine. For Job and Enoch had lived at a location near what is now known as Jerusalem, and they were the first ones to name the city in that land Jerusalem, or Ur-Usalem, Ur rather than Jer, because Ur meant city and Salem meant city of peace. So therefore, in the days of Enoch and Job, it was called Ur-Usalem, a city of peace, and the city of the God of peace. And whereas it was quite a city, basically they had agriculture, and they also had their flocks. And their herds and flocks, they grazed all around on the outside, but the people were supported by these herds and by their agriculture. And it was from this city that Enoch and Job had gathered their savants to go down to Egypt. So approximately at the same time, and shall we say maybe 100 years between the period of 5100 B.C. to 5000 B.C., not over 50 years thereafter, is when Aryans moved into India and had built that observing center up there. Now, it wasn't until it's a possibility that we might have 200 years differentiation here in that Enoch had his experience because he was taken out into space by the angels. And he traveled in this ship, and he was shown all these mysteries, and he was told what he was to write, and of course he and Enoch, Job, had his experiences too, and went down there to not only build this city, but to build this pyramid eventually, and to put these things within it. Now, therefore, knowing that this had to be the prelude before his advent into Egypt, it's a possible thing that the actual knowledge concerning how to set up this sky measure may not have taken place till maybe after the 100 years or so, or before he migrated to Egypt, because one of the first things we know must have been done is that Enoch communicated what he had been taught, and runners carried this to all the outposts of our race. They had to carry it back to the Sethite sons to get the full story of what they were waiting for, and vice versa. They had to, everywhere where they were white men, Persia, over in the Aryan migrations in India, and down into Egypt, was the same knowledge concerning where to look for and what the signs were, and over also in Britain. Now, we know that the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, Lombard migrations into Europe didn't take place until Shalmaneser, the Assyrian, had given his freedom to the captive tribes of Israel. We know that the captivity of Israel, we know when it took place, and we know that as far as the last of the tribes to fall was in 586 B.C. when to 584, and this is when Babylon took over Jerusalem and took Judah and Benjamin captive. We know, therefore, that there was no migrations of the Israel segment of the Adamic race into Europe, except for the Scythians, which migrated about 80 years before the rest of them, which formed the Greek settlements of Scythia, which is Greece. And that they came through first, and Greece was set up first, and then the rest of the white race that made Western Europe came through the Caucasus, through the Caucasian Mountains, and of course when they arrived out in Britain, such as the Anglo-Saxons, the House of Joseph, they already found white men some there who were picked, and these of course were Aryans, that a few of them, though they were very primitive, but they in the areas of hadn't built great cities or anything, but they had built this tremendous astronomical observatory. And they did have in they had cave they had in they had built stone dwellings, some of which were covered with heavy mounds of dirt, and they had buildings which they had made of woods, the wood shelters, wattled wood shelters of what. So there was dwellers on Ireland when the Anglo-Saxons arrived, and they found them there. And of course the tribe of Dan, which settled in Denmark, and part of Dan went over into Ireland, and Ireland is made up partly of Dan, partly out of these Picts, see. So, but the thing that was significant about it is that among the Danites that settled partly in Ireland was some of the descendants of the throne of David, but they were descendants among the rebels that had gone out with the 10 tribes. And so Hergerman of Ireland, who was the king over Ireland at the time of the fall of Judah and Benjamin, in the land of Palestine, when Babylon took them, he was at 586 B.C. Hergerman was the king in Ireland, a Davidic line ruling over the Anglo-Saxon peoples, which were now in Europe and settled down, to the extent that here we have Hergerman, king of Ireland, a descendant of the Israel seed that is settled in Ireland, but the predominant population was Anglo and Saxon. Or of the house of Joseph, and Picts and Danites had the throne in Ireland ruling over them of David. And that's why Jeremiah took Tetaphi, the daughter of Zedekiah, which is what we referred to here in the book of Ezekiel, where he took the tender twig and planted it by the great waters in the land of the plantations. And then the throne moved from Ireland to Scotland to Wales, and by the time it's moved from Scotland to Wales, it's in the full heart of Anglo-Saxonism, and the whole Isles are well knit together. Now, knowing therefore this time, we know that Stonehenge was built back at the same time that Doering and the others were built. So we would say that there was a period of some 4,500 years of Stonehenge existence before any of our Anglo-Saxon brethren arrived here. But when our Anglo-Saxon brethren arrived, they had in their minds, our forebears, they had a knowledge of the wisdom and the mysteries which came out of the basic original Masonic lore, or the mysteries of the temple teaching that go all the way back to the days of Enoch and Job. And so in these mysteries of Enoch and Job were kept not only measures of the sky, because this was never codified in writing until Enoch put it in writing, with the exception that in the books of the Bee, if you can find a complete one, which follows the book of Seth, that God had told Seth of things that would happen concerning also his own messiahship, and the signs would be in the heavens, and they would be made known unto him. So the book of the Bee does have some configurations in, but the book of the Bee, like the book of the Zohar and like Dasher, is computed to have been added to and to have lasted over a period of quite a bit of time, because things that God showed them or taught them that were divine revelation went into the book of the Bee. So like the Zohar, the Bee contained the fact that there would be certain signs in the heavens to mark the coming of Messiah, and that two of the great wanderers would come together, and that when they came together, that the third time, that the Messiah would be born. So that would climax the pregnancy of Mary, and there would be ultimately a conjunction in the sky at the time of the birth of Christ. So remember that this is way back. This is back in the days of Seth, who is the first accepted son of Adam. And of course, the gestations that took place there over a period of a few years might have only marked 10 or 12 years of time before Seth was born, back after Adam was driven out of Eden. So this gives us a pretty close dating to the fact that Stonehenge is around 5,000 B.C. And when our forebears went in, one of the great wisdom schools of their learning involved what later was called Druidry. Now remember that we went in with our tribal heritage and background, that we had our high priests, and the high priests that were with the Anglo-Saxon people were similar to the high priests of Israel, that since the seed of the throne had been transplanted in the Isles, in this was very significant because remember that when by the time that that during the ministry of Christ, that the Isles of Britain was well known to be the household of Israel, for this is where Joseph of Arimathea owned his hides of land. Here's where the first Christian church was built. Here's where Jesus, while visiting after going over there on a ship of Joseph of Arimathea, built the Wattle Church of Glastonbury. Here is where later after Christ's ascension, that Mary was taken by Joseph and some of the apostles over to Britain to live out her years in security where she wouldn't be persecuted by the Palestinian Jews. And so this is on land that would belong to Joseph. And where she stayed, there's a well, and this well is called the well is called Mary's Well, and it's a freshwater well that has always had good, cold, clear water. And this is at Glastonbury. And so the tomb of Mary is at Glastonbury today, where Mary is supposed to be buried. And there's no doubt that she wasn't bodily assumed into heaven, that she was buried there. And of course, in Ireland is the tomb of Jeremiah, who they called in Irish Olam Fala, who brought the princess. And this is a part of their tradition, and they know where he's buried and what tor and mound it's in, and so forth. And here is the tor that the ancient lore tells us they had buried the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant had been taken from there, and when Westminster Abbey was built at London, and this was land that belonged also to Joseph of Arimathea, of course, that they had built this abbey on, and this ancient abbotry, and Westminster Abbey is the house of God westward, Jerusalem was the house of God eastward, and here in the floor, just before the coronation chair, is a slab of stone, and all these mosaics are fitted in, and this one is a hollow slab, and this slab is the exact size of the Ark of the Covenant. And records show that ancient Druid and Masonic leaders took the Ark out of its dwelling place, the cave, took the handles off, and put it down under the floor in Westminster Abbey, and that this is where the Ark of the Covenant was placed. And this is the exact same size. There has been some who said, well, the Ark of the Covenant was received up into the heavens until the time of the return of Christ. But there is quite a bit of evidence to the effect that the Ark was taken by Jeremiah, along with the showers of salt and all these sacred things, which are today in the British Tower of London and which are used at coronation time. All these go back, just like on the wall of Buckingham Palace, is the entire genealogy of the Queen of England all the way back down to David. Queen Elizabeth goes all the way back to David in the line. Now, and it goes right down and takes this genealogy right straight back to Ireland, and then from TTP, brought over by Jeremiah, right back again to Zedekiah. And, of course, the scriptures tell us that when, here in Ezekiel, that when the king of Babylon came and carried Zedekiah and his sons captive to Babylon, that they were killed. But God did not let this end it, that he cropped a tender twig off of the top of the high branch. And he had planted this by the great waters, and it grew to be a great branch that spread over the walls in the mountain of one of the highest nations of God's kingdom. So he dried up the green tree and caused the dry side of the kingdom now to flourish, throne transplanted. Now, the fact is that those men, when they arrived in ancient Druidry, they knew what that Stonehenge was for, and they knew it was to measure the precession of the equinoxes. They had this lore still alive from the days of the founding of Masonic wisdom. This was known in the days of Solomon, and it had been known by David. David shows a lot in his writings of the secret lore and of the things which he showed, and the Spirit moved upon him, and he writes this right in the Psalms. In fact, a person that was a real light carrier and had not just gone through masonry with a bang just to get the degrees so that they could join the Shriners or something, if they hadn't been piked and messed up by the invasion, which tried to change the doctrines of masonry, just like today it has invaded the church, they would discover, if they read with their eyes open the Psalms, they would just get thrill after thrill of Masonic wisdom that is hidden away in the Psalms, see? Because these secrets keep bouncing out here and there. Now, if one had all 163 books, plus or minus the few that were spurious, you discover that the 163 scrolls that contains so much of the wisdom of the things of God. And it is my personal belief that if we had 163 of these scrolls here intact today, and that we could pursue them, that we would finally throw out 10 of them. I am of the opinion that there was exactly as many inspired scrolls as there was a displacement factor. And just as Jesus had them count the fish in the net, it was 153, I think there was 153 inspired scrolls or sacred writings. And I think 10 of them were phony, like the Songs of Solomon, the Book of Esther, and some of the others. But I think there's 153 inspired scrolls, just as one quarter of the 612 luminaries was 153, and this was the exact gestation displacement factor that was involved by the fall of our race. Because when we violated divine law and we had lost the aura of light and glory, and the law of sin and death took over in our physical bodies, the gestation period from 360 days to 9 months was the result. And women now brought forth child with pain and suffering, and we were all of us cut out, not 3 months of the period of the vibrations of all of the celestial synthesis of the universe. So this left us incomplete and under the law of sin and death. Now, the reason why the zodiac measure was so important is in the Gospel Message of the Stars, the prophecy was given that when God had consummated his purposes and had become embodied in earth and had fulfilled his work in as the messianic completer to restore his people, that when this transpired, he would have finished the law of judgment and restored us back to the law of life and would have been our completer, and therefore would have set aside all the displacement which evil had caused. And he cited that this might not be understood until the day when he finished his measure and the second alignment patterns came in and the king had joined his people and finishes his kingdom in the earth. So this being known, therefore, remember that whereas in Christ's atonement, he paid the price, he restored us by spirit and by faith, no condemnation rested upon us. And according to our faith to perceive it, and the function which was the climax of these latter days, but was as available as we had the capacity to perceive, the spirit of Christ, the law of atonement, now restored to us, which he, the capstone and the completer, could alone do, had given back to us what we had lost by the original fall of our race. So therefore, whereas we had the displacement factor of 153, or everybody, according to the time of their birth, was just incomplete 3 months, this was the law of sin and death. This was the quadrant of design. This was the thing, the reason why everybody would have certain tendencies much alike, according to when they were born, would be affected by the same vibratory impact of the universe, and so forth. And in this pattern, there would be all of the guilt complex measures adjusted by this, that would even give a person a life expectancy, a time when they anticipated they would die. All top psychiatrists realize today that people build up and it develops as they subconsciously probe for the least common denominator between the background of their inheritance and their forefathers, and they get an idea that they expect to live about so long. Some think they're going out in 70, and some 80, and some 90, and some think they're maybe going to make 95, and then there's some of us don't think we're going to go at all. But the fact remains that because of that, the only reason why we think this is that we have accepted the completion and the law of the spirit of life in Christ Jesus, which is referred to in this mystery of the Paul and Romans, has made us free from this law of sin and death. This doesn't mean that you don't make mistakes, but that you have already accepted a law of life and a finished atonement. Whereas other people have accepted this in mind, but they still are anticipating or setting up the clockwork that starts organic failure and causes AIDS. This is why as we reach the end of this age, as knowledge was to increase and spiritual revelation was to be restored, the spiritual energy and the kinetic energy it would release and the energy that would move out of the celestial consciousness was going to start rebuilding the human body of our race. And before this climax of this age, which is now coming fast to a close, God says, I will do a short work of righteousness, and after this will I come. And he said, when I present this people unto myself, my household, my faith, there's not going to be a wrinkle, a spot, or a blemish. So in other words, this is restored life. This is vitality. This is completion. This means then that what we lost by a 9 month gestation because of the fall, he as the completer has completed, and thus therefore the spiritual vitality of the flow of spiritual forces from the father to the children, and this as it's admitted by the soul consciousness as we reach out to receive this, and we synthesize ourselves into the plans of God that reach out into eternity, and we think in terms of race and destiny and origin and purpose, we are already rebuilding the areas of vitality that all the other frictions and anticipations and fears would destroy. So therefore, this is why, again, we say that they were vitally concerned in this, because this secret lore is deep in Druidry. It's deep in the inner core of the real light carriers, which was the real heart of Maestri. Now, it's true that they use the term later in the word magician is not a good word. But the word magician comes from the wisdom of the Magi. And the Magi were our Sethite forefathers. And remember that Job was a Magi. Remember that Enoch was Magi. They descended from the Sethites. They were true Israel because they were God's princes ruling in earth, and before the name was placed on Jacob to later be known as a national name. But remember that in this issue, that these men were men of wisdom, patriarchal leaders, and they were virtual astronomers and scientists, divinely taught at a high heavenly level. The wisdom and the lore in the secrets of Enoch and the astronomical observation that they were inspired to make, and their knowledge of the applications of various laws of physics that caused them to be able to elevate massive stones that we can't lift today without a locomotive derrick, and still we can't fit them like they did, proved that this divine wisdom that was given to Enoch and to Job and given to our race even at that time was of intense scientific value and of extreme brilliance and high intellectual, spiritual level intellectuality because of its impact. We haven't been able today to find any areas of contemporary science that can be as accurate and can do as much as we were able to do even at that time. Though we have today with our skyscrapers and our vast bridges and our technology and our spacecraft and so forth, we have proved that there is nothing that we set our minds to do that the areas of our inspiration cannot accomplish. But the fact is we have not as yet fathomed some of the things which they did without the machinery we're using today to do it. So that it was known that these men, therefore, that could use such intense spiritual wisdom for such dynamic concentration were called magicians, because they could use spiritual wisdom and direct application of power without machinery to get the job done. And such men that carried this wisdom were magi. Now, some of them didn't always have the knowledge in all the areas of physics, maybe, but many of them were astronomers. This is why when these three Aryan princes, with a fourth one late, arrived to find the birth of Christ and said, we saw his star, we came to worship him. What did they call them? Magi. Why did they call them Magi? Because they came from these wise, divinely taught race, and they were savants. Their life was devoted to keeping alive and passing on this knowledge. In the early wisdom, and it's still known by certain areas of this wisdom school, they knew what this thing was for. Now, I there are some things that I can't discuss tonight about Britain and London and Druidry, but I can tell you this, that while these men spent 2.5 hours or three on a symposium, that there are some great intellectuals in Britain who could take them into a huge oak tree through a door in a very fine oak row to a vast underground grotto where there's one of the finest temples of Druidry in the world today and show them the whole thing, see? In fact, we have a friend who was in high up in education in San Diego County, and he attended our meetings, and he discovered the great mystery of the two obelisks, one the Mark of Ephraim, the other Mark of Manasseh, one on the Thames Embankment, and the other was in Central Park in New York. So when I told him what was on these two obelisks, that they're written in Egyptian, was the history of the house of Joseph, and one said the Mark of Ephraim, and it told, and the other the Mark of Manasseh, and they had followed his steps. And on these two obelisks, which was set up by Queen Hatshepsut in honor of Joseph, and they named them after Joseph's two sons, and told the whole story of how Joseph rose in Egypt to great power and splendor, and how he had married Asenath, and how these two sons were born, and what a contribution he had made to Egypt, and how he had saved them with wisdom in an hour of their famine, and how the houses of Joseph would be received with honor, and how he had married these Magi people, or this white race On, whose temple priesthood was there, and how Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On, which we find here in the scriptures, described as the girl which Joseph married. He didn't marry Egyptian. He went down to the temple of On and married Asenath, daughter of Potiphar. So here is the fact by the Egyptians themselves that Joseph's two sons were the sons of this strange white aristocracy that ran this mystery city of On, and knew and the temples of the sky and had all this wisdom. And this is on this. So this man went to New York and he looked at this tent, it's a little weather-beaten from the cold and the freezing and the change of weather. Remember that it was because of our participation with Britain in Egyptology and digging up the old treasures in Egypt. And, of course, this made a lucrative business for Egypt because people came down to see the tombs and everything. And Egypt felt quite kindly towards America and Britain. And they gave us these two obelisks. And one of them they was set up over in Britain and the other was set up here. That's how they arrived. But by the strangeness of design and destiny, the one they gave us is the mark of Manasseh. May it follow his steps. Now, it's been more weather-beaten from the action of rain and cold and freezing here than even the one in Britain. And it was when it first arrived, it was real sharp. Anyhow, I knew what was on it. And when I told this man what was on it, he went to back there, and he went to the Museum of Natural History, and he went to the area, the room of Egyptology, Syriology, and he asked them if they could tell him what was on this obelisk. And they said, well, no, they couldn't tell him what was on it, but that some years ago they had pulled an impression on it when it first arrived, and this impression had been permanently photographed, and that their Egyptology specialist could tell them. It was just been set up in the days of Queen Hatshepsut. It was one of Queen Hatshepsut's needles. So this man says, but I know what's on it. I said, how do you know? He says, because my pastor told me what was on it out in California. Well, he says, that's strange. Did he come down here and translate it? No. He says, how does he know? Well, he just told me what was on it. He said, it's the story of one of Joseph, and this one says the mark of Manasseh, and it's a part of the story of Joseph in Egypt, and the other half of it's over in England, and the other half of the story says the mark of Ephraim. So the fellow said, I'll tell you what we'll do. He says, I'll take you to my Egyptologist. So the Egyptologist says, well, I don't know. He says, I know it pertains to the dynasty of Queen Hatshepsut, and it relates to the time old back, he says, that early in the history of Egypt, he said. He says, especially in the second, third dynasty, he says, we'll check it out. He says, tell you, going to be in New York for a while? He says, yes, 2 days. He says, you come back in 2 days, I'll tell you what's on it. Well, he says, I know what's on it. The man says, you know what's on it? He says, what's on it? So he told him, it's got the history of House of Joseph on it. He said, George Washington knew that. So this fellow thought he was cracked. But so when Mr. Potter went back to the museum, that was the curator, went down to the Egyptologist and he said to him, did you get this translated? Yes. He says, I'm waiting for the man to return. He says, I'm amazed. And so when our friend returned, he said, now, he says, you're right. He says, this has got the history of the house of Joseph on it, and it's the Joseph that went into Egypt of the Bible story record, and it's the story of who he married and his two sons and of how they are to be received and honored inside of Egypt. So he said, I'd like to know more about how they know this. Well, he said, you know about the history of the entire race and the migrations of it, you'd understand. He says, but this is a part of the ancient wisdom lore that has been carried down as to what was on those to this day. And it's Masonic secrets in the light carriers, and it is a Druid secret, and it was known to George Washington, who, while he was a master mason, it didn't go into all these foolish pagan rites, and he didn't go to the silly Jew shrine. He was still, this masonry was a light carrier unit, and they knew that the pyramid was an ideal symbol of messianic building, and that we had destiny that related to the house of Joseph and was tied in to the two sons of Joseph and Anglo-Saxonism. So, when he arrived in England, he went to the British Museum, and he asked them if they knew what was on this pillar out there in the Thames embankment, and they said no. So he told them what was on it, and told them what was on the one over here, and they said, well, we'll go check this right away, because we have the plates and all the things we've drawn. And they said, we could tell you this in even a few minutes. We could tell you if it starts out like this. And sure enough, it was the mark of Ephraim. And I had gotten this because Professor Totten knew all about this in Yale University, because he went back to all the things that came out that George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, John Adams had used when they chose various emblems and tied them into our scripture, and why they made the Washington Monument a great obelisk. You see, the highest obelisk in the world that makes Queen Hatshepsut's needles look like toys is that Washington Monument. Because George Washington was a master mason, and he knew that there was two needles that was existent in Egypt. And of course, when George Washington was the president, they were still in the sand. And he knew about the Sphinx, and he knew about the pyramid, and he knew about the capstone not being on it, and all about this, because this was known way back there by George Washington, and Zeiss was writing about it in the 1800s, but they didn't bring the obelisks over here till after the Civil War. So you see, way after that. So you see, this shows you how far-reaching this knowledge and the secrets of this knowledge really was. So when they translated it and found it was this way, they made quite a bit about it. And of course, then from here, Mr. Proctor went from here, he had quite a talk with the abbotry leaders in Westminster Abbey, and they knew the secrets of the ark was supposed to be there. They knew that that was the stone of scone that was in that chair. And they sent him over to Glastonbury and told him where to find a rector in a church who would be the key to it. And so while he was there, he took certain keys and certain information, and the rector was kind enough to pass it on. And Mr. Proctor was introduced to the chief druid, who holds today the title that belongs to Merlin, who during the days of King Athelstane, who was later known as King Arthur, he was the chief high priest of Israel, then in Britain, wore the breastplate with the 12 stones, was called a magi, but this is because it was an interwoven pattern. And so this again, he was by permission, because of this, taken through the oak tree and into the temple, and he beheld all this, and he was allowed to go through one whole druid night when leaders and statesmen and others that knew this came and assembled here in a vast oak grove in this great walled wood. And he had this tremendous experience. And when he came back, he was so bubbling with experience. He says, "I could never doubt again," he said. He says, "The thing which you have confirmed for us, I never doubted that these things were true, but your confirmation and your experiences and what you have just established, how accurate our tradition has been preserved unto us with all the attempts to destroy. And strangely, God has always been bringing all these things together for us, so that whatsoever thing we started on, we were finding more and more of it and fitting and finding more of the pieces. And so we knew that these pieces were right, and we have a confirmation. Mr. Proctor belongs to our congregations. They live in Pasadena. He's now retired from any activity in his former business. He's no longer one of the leaders of the school board in San Diego. He's retired. But the fact is that this is just a little concerning this. Now, tied into this lore is Stonehenge. Stonehenge that measures the precession that made it possible for them to know, even at the London level, that the Messiah was about to come. That they could tell it from Persia, that they could tell it from Egypt. So Egypt used the alignment planes from the pyramid and the sky measure there. So we know when it was made. We know it never was a pagan temple, and it wasn't built to behead people like some of the superstitious people think that the druids were a bloodthirsty cult, and this is where they executed people out here in the middle of this deal. And this was there wasn't any truth about this. It is true that they used to slay a lamb, and they did this at the proper time in the solstice, and they slew a lamb, which was a part of our ancient heritage, and this lamb was a symbol of their faith in atonement. And that's why there was a sacrificial altar. But old Druidry knew this, and it was not a place of human sacrifice. And human sacrifice did not have a place in Druidry. And this is just as foolish as some of the things they say about you.
The 56 holes that are around it, do you know what the significance is?
Well, I could go to some scroll material I have here, and I could tell you, I would have to determine from whence the numbers come. In other words, in setting up Stonehenge, it depends on where they start their numbers as to what's the fifth and sixth hole. If they took it from our Aryan forebearers' measure, it might not be the fifth and sixth hole of their measure today. So I would have to see how it's setting for their fifth and sixth hole to give you an answer. But I can show you a Druid Bible. Well, you get eclipses when they come. Eclipses don't come with periodic regularity, so that the eclipse would always occur in some one of these holes centered. But if one went to one of these positions to observe the eclipse through it, and sighted across the ring, they could find the relationship of this eclipse to the patterns of alignment, and they could know by this procedure just where on the face of the Earth this eclipse would be at total, if it was. Just like I can take an astrolabe, I could bring an astrolabe out here, and I can rotate this astrolabe, and it doesn't make any difference what day of the year from here on out. We can show you just what the sky is going to look like at this time of day, at this spot in the Earth, if we could see through it. Now, that's all on the astrolabe, it's all there. Now, at this, with the same astrolabe, I can take my setting circles on my Questar, or I can take an experiment as to the position, latitude and longitude, and position of the conjoining of the planet. And I can come back over here on the ring of this and show you exactly where they're going to be and know just in what configuration, at what measure they're going to be. But I can take the same experiments and tell you exactly where these eclipses are going to line up. They did that with that great big Stonehenge. These fellas were pretty smart, and that's how they did it. And, I mean, they had all this down, right, straight down from days of Enoch. Another question. We'll go into this some more with charts one of these days, photographs. All we need to do is just photograph it, throw it up on the wall, and talk about it. Another question?
How did you happen to be doing more, or could you be able to explain something more about the group research?
Group research is an institution set up by a bunch of Jews to gain files, as far as they are capable of doing, on every person they suspect of being a right-winger in America. Having gained this file, they set it up, and then from this time on, they locate his job, and if they wish to, they see through their pressures that this man is laid off first. And then they see that when he goes to an employment office, he's already blacklisted and he can't get one. And they are plotting to force economic destruction upon the right wing. Having accomplished this economic destruction, they hope that they will be forced to turn to outlawry and crime so that they will be able to throw them in penitentiaries or shoot them down without trouble. The only thing they overlook is that there's more of us than there are of them, and that we must catalyze the strength of our own society so that Jews don't determine who the majority of us hire. Now, don't think that there's any way you can run out on it and escape this. They've already got you pinpointed. I'll tell you this. If they have every all over in blocks, in the streets, in the places of business, in downtown, always the ear and eye of the Jew and their proselytes that listen for anything that might be aware of anything that relates to them, or if somebody was strong maybe for Goldwater, or if somebody was strong for, even though that wasn't satisfactory enough, even so, because this would identify them as being right or extremely right. It wouldn't make any difference what facet of right-wing activity, if somebody was opposed to socialism, someone who wanted to deport all the communists, if somebody was against the disarmament policies, or they were against the United Nations, they make group research, and group research records it. Now, I happen to know, there's a couple here who know, that an associate was able to tap one of the real centers for the classification of group research information. And while there, they had a file that they were then classifying on the Christian Defense League. And whether the world thinks it's doing a lot or not, the Jews knew it was. They knew its impact, psychologically, what it's doing. They had the names of everybody. Sticking them on the board, see? Run them through this IBM machine, the classification. They had every other patriotic group, but they had this one. They just happened, fortunately, that the timing that brought him into this establishment led him able to see this. Without the man who was there being aware that he even knew anything about this, and a casual question brought up a candid answer. Now, I have the document that was even published in the newspaper across the entire nation and in all the major Hearst papers on how group research operates, and that it successfully was going out to economically destroy and to take over, to destroy the right wing and then take over. Now, they may feel so successful today with this fantastic grand society They may feel so confident with what they think is their strength in Congress, they might relax a little on this and figure they're going to do it with legislation, force us to jump through their skipping rope anyhow. I'm going to tell you something tonight. They better keep their nose to the grindstone, because instead of any design for surrender or retreat or go back in the corner now and watch and see, we as a people must become more aggressive than ever before. We must win more people in this we're doing, and we must get tape to more people. Every design that Lucifer can concoct to stop tape, not because we are putting this tape out, but I believe tonight that the size of the tape expansion, its circuits and its multiplicity in number, that this is the strongest single wave of alerting, educational, explosive attack on the enemy that exists, with all of the realization that big organizations are moving, spending millions of dollars in literature, the Hargis machine and the various Fundamental Ministerial Association and all these others. I'm still going to tell you that we have, that because of the speed, this area of coverage, because of the alerting of the people that multiply and repeat this, I think that we are doubling this year, and we'll continue to double, the number of the people that will think right, that will align their thinking with our race, with our faith, and with our national destiny. Now, this, and the thing that makes this possible is the vast number of people that helps it catalyze this. So, this is the reason why group research can twiddle their fingers, but they don't know how to stop this. And there's too many people waking up to become aware of this. And so we're not going to let up on this, because again, all the nation must always be alert to this until we can bring sufficient pressures on all the various hiring agencies in this area. Another question.
Do you think any of those firearms bills would ever be passed?
There's always a possibility that they'll seek to put them in. These firearm bills, of course, they have not been coming out of committee. They've had several real corny ones up already in the state, and haven't come out of committee. I'm assured that the pressures are going to be terrific. Probably never get them out of committee. I think that the tax bill he's trying to put over, I think this will never get out of committee. Besides, these politicians can't afford to disturb 3 million sportsmen that in just one field alone. Say nothing of all the rifle pistol clubs, all the firearms industry, the sporting goods industry. Too big a lobby. The man that does that will never be president.
Hey, what do you think of this move to Paul Brown? I've got a couple petitions if anybody's in there.
Probably, let's say this, it wouldn't be advantageous for us in a Bible study to discuss this. The reason for this is that that they could not say then that we directed a political measure. Recall is a political initiative. So we can't tell you what we think, but as far as the measure, why we think that this is a natural, logical outcome because of conduct, and as far as Brown is concerned, well, I think he earned it. Another question.
You know, I'm a little confused on the difference between the Torah and Tungus. Are they the same? I thought one time I knew the difference.
Well, I'll tell you what the Tungus man. The Tungus man is one of the oldest racial identifications of the original and oldest race that we have record of on the earth. Now, we have fossils that go back a million now and a half years. And pieces of fossils and evidences of civilization. Artifacts and so forth. We have fossils and we have definite technological accurate datings now for 600,000 years of the Tungus man, which is the same as the steppes from Asia. And we have him wandering all over the earth. We got evidence of this. Now, when the Tungus man was living in the areas which is now known as the Sahara Desert, but was once a beautiful and great forested land, they were called Tarog. And there are some people today, desert tribes, fierce ones, terrific fighters, tall, who are called Torahs, but they're not Negroids, and they're not Arabs, and they are very light, but they have a slight Asiatic cast to the skull. And when classified, they come under the Asiatic skull type and not the white type. Now, these fossils have been found of the people called Tuareg for many thousands of years. We find fossils of these people, even though they might be a regathering of these people in our time. They have always apparently been wandering nomads, and the word Tuareg is sometimes used interchangeably for migration, battling, fighting nomadic Tungus. But you see, the Tungus, the Asiatic, the original people in the world, the first creation that God put here, not offspring, just a creation here, started here, this was home. They were Tungus. Wasn't anything wrong with them as long as they stayed in line. After the Luciferian situation, they might not have been held totally responsible for their fall. But, of course, just how many species might have been here, I wouldn't want to cite. There's evidence that there may have been as many as 7 races at one time upon the earth. And there were mutations and catastrophes. We know that there were several types of people living in the areas of Lemuria before it went down. But we have also certain universal factors, and we do have a very definite, the Tungus type skull and fossils found from the Andes Mountains all the way from Easter Island, Samara, down to Samoa, and over to down to Java, all over Asia.
You did then use the word Tungus and Tuareg interchangeably
at times. Only when I talked about them in a certain location. When they got down from the high steppes in around the areas from Mesopotamia over around the Sahara Desert, then we used the word Tuareg. Now, today some of the most fierce battlers of that whole area are Tuareg. And they wear a sort of a mask around them. In fact, I'll tell you something rather strange. The Tuaregs wear a cloak when they ride out to attack. Looks like the Ku Klux Klan. That's right. It's very similar to this, see? This is a significant thing. They wore this type of cloak, and sometimes they just wore the pointed cap with just a band across their face, see? But this had no relationship to the Klan, but the fact is they were doing this way back over 1,000 years ago. In fact, the Tuaregs were quite fierce way back in the days when Genghis Khan's hordes were going and when we were fighting the Crusades. These rascals were there. And they still come sleeping out there with camels and with fast horses, and they give a bad time to modern mechanized equipment. Of course, now the French and any of the others who were trying to hold down these wild tribes could move in now with an airplane and a few machine guns and kind of take care of the situation. But not that they do. I'm not so sure they do too much about it. But except when they attack the caravan routes of some big oil company. Another question?
In Revelation chapter 8, the first verse, is that symbolic? And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Is that something symbolic?
It's exactly this. In other words, if a day is for a year in prophetic measurement, then you would have an hour would be 15 days. In other words, that you got 12 months of the year, 30 days, relatively speaking. So half, dividing it up into 24 hours, an hour is 15 days, a half hour is 7.5 days at that scale. See? So, therefore, this is indicative of a measure, and it's symbolic, and it's a long subject. We'll get into it here. And he opened the seventh seal, and there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Then the seven angels before God stood before God and were given the 7 trumpets, and the angels came and stood before the altar with the golden censer and so forth. Now, the censer, of course, was symbolic, supposedly, of the prayers of the saints. Now, this is the symbol of the catalyst of the awareness of the offspring reaching for spiritual power, catalyzed together. The emanation of the aura of this is referred to as the censer and the incense. and the aura is here referred to, and it's offered with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. Now, this word, the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. This was the catalyst of the aura of light that formed with an effulgent mist before the throne, showing the energy of the catalyst of the suns as the energy between heaven and earth thus spiritually was united. Now, actually, we have this effulgence lifted up in the temple when Isaiah said, "And I entered into the temple." And he tells you just what day in the days of King Uzziah, and he saw the throne of God high lifted up. And he said that as he saw it, that the light or the aura of God filled the whole place like smoke. Now, I'll show you this, the book of Isaiah. And, of course, this is, you may note in your references, a affinity here between these two. So this is a period of the catalyzation or the charging of the sons of God with the will of God prior to their becoming aware of the cycle of acts and the things that are to transpire. And as their union in spirit is synchronized with that of the celestial throne, then this great catalyst of light or this energy pattern on the heavenly level is like incense or like an effulgent glory rising before the Most High. This shows that the Spirit has ignited the consciousness for reception, and this effulgent smoke is just radiant emanation aura or glory of Spirit. Now let's go back here to Isaiah, and we see this here in the very beginning of the book of Isaiah. It's something we should probably should be discussed all the subject by itself, but here. So, in the sixth chapter of the book of Isaiah, in the year of King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Now, this train was an emanating, effulgent light that radiated forth from him, just like a robe reaching out, just like the ermine of royalty. It was made of effulgent light flowing. Now it was, and he said that he saw the seraphims that were before him, and he heard them say, "Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And he said that the very doorposts vibrated, just pulsed like they were breathing as before the voice of the Eternal One. And he said that and the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Well, this word smoke is effulgent glory. So thick was this effulgent glory that it looked just like rolling clouds, like smoke, like the substance. Now, you note that in the days of the Exodus, when Yahweh came down and stood with Moses as he promised him, and as the children of Israel marched from the land of Goshen down to the Red Sea, the great master craft was in a cloud. It says that it was in a cloud, and it was a cloud of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, the word smoke is not proper. It was an effulgent Shekinah. It was thick, almost like mist, but it was radiant. It was an effulgent cloud of smoke. Well, it was effulgent glory. But they couldn't see through it. They couldn't see the great capital ship that was up there, but it says, for Yahweh was not only with them. Then when they got down here to the Red Sea, and here was the armies of Pharaoh changing their mind and coming after them, the war chariots of Pharaoh moving in behind 3 million people, and Moses took his staff, and then the command comes for him to reach it out over the water, and as he reaches out, touch the water, a great catalyst of light and as a column of this glory moves right down to the water, and the water divides and rolls back, and this whole 3 million people march across on the still damp but dry bottom, relative, there was no water bothering them, right through the Red Sea, while the water stood up on both sides. Now, you're told that above them went the clouds, but we are told in the Zohar that a column of this effulgent smoke or a cloud of light came right down to the water and was going before them as they went. And then a cloud went behind them And Moses waited till the last man went through that water. Then Moses followed now on behind them with his staff. And when he got to the other side, he stretched forth the staff, and it says, and the smoke did rise into the clouds of smoke, or the Shekinah glory. In the meantime, here were all these charging armies of Pharaoh running down into about 18 foot of water. It all came together and drowned them. That's why the song of Moses and the Lamb, which you get over here in the book of Revelation, the horse and his rider hath he cast into the sea. Now, whenever you get a cloud of smoke, the symbolism of the smoke coming up out of a censer, and then they tell you that this censer is the incense, and the smoke raises before the altars the prayers of the saints. This is all mystery. It's all written in symbolic language, and it's unto you it's given to know, and to them it is not given. You know, we got a lot of people today, they're so superstitious they're afraid to discuss the book of Revelation, because the last thing it says in the book is that anybody that changes one dotting of an I or one crossing of a T of anything that's written in this book, all the curses will be added to him of everything that is written in this book. Now, you say, well, doesn't that mean that? Well, if we had this in its original text, in the accuracy and in the perfection with which John received it on the Isle of Patmos, then nobody that understood it would change it, and the ones that would change it would be the enemy. But the fact remains that, therefore, that to interpret it is not to change it. And there are people afraid to interpret it for fear as they interpret it, they've changed it. There are some things in here that have been changed. They have changed the instructions which were given, for instance, to the overcomer, will I give this and will I give that? Say. And they said to the overcomer, I will not blot his name out of the Lamb's Book of Life. Say. Well, nobody ever had their name blotted out of the Lamb's Book of Life. If you ever got your name in it, it was in there forever. God didn't change his mind. So they said, well, what? Well, God said, to him that is the overcomer, will I give unto him to know that his name has been written forever in the Lamb's Book of Life. I haven't taken anything out of it. I just told you what was there. But they said, but now what the church did in the translations through Rome and through King James, when they said to the overcomer, I will not blot his name out of the Lamb's Book of Life, this gave them a little doctrine book. They could shake the whip over anybody that disobeyed and said, look out, you're not an overcomer, you get your name blotted out. Unless they put some words in the mouth of God, see? I never said I'm going to blot anybody's name out. Didn't even use the word blot. So this is why, again, in a mystery like this, this mystery is the catalyst now, since this, the prayer, the whole process of prayer is a very much misunderstood process. It's not just just telling God a bunch of things. Not by the process of running our lips or just trying to let God know something. There isn't anybody here that's ahead of God. There isn't anybody in this room could tell God anything. Not a person could tell God anything. In the day you got a secret that God doesn't know that you can tell God, then God has dropped behind you and you don't need him. So omniscience is his attribute. So then what is this prayer business? All right, we synchronize the soul and the body as we meditate upon truth, and we live where we think. And thus our soul consciousness, which is our resident personality, as we synchronize our thinking with the thinking of God, some people might call this meditation, but it is true communion, which is real prayer. And as we adjust our thinking to the things that God is thinking, we learn. He tells us. We don't tell him. But at the same time, we review in our own consciousness, because you can't help it, the areas of your conduct or your plans as they fit into this. But the prayer is adjusting you. It's not telling God anything. It don't change God. Prayer don't change God. It changes things as it relates to you and your perspective of it. So by this process, then, when we talk about the prayers of the saints, when the children of the Most High, in the hour of great prophetic purpose or great inner world activity, whenever they become so moved that it is a symbol of their stillness to be instructed, and their meditation catalyzes itself in the presence of God like incense rising before God from his altar, then you can know that God's doing a great work of righteousness. He's teaching his children, and they're listening. And this is its symbol. And thus it was that when the people came before God and they made their sacrifice and they listened for his answer, and the high priest went into the Holy of Holies to get the answer, and the incense would rise from the altar. Now this is no sacrifice that's burning on an altar, but this is a living sacrifice in a living temple, catalyzed as the individual reaches for the guidance of the Father, that he might perform the areas of his responsibility best. So God does this through multiple procedures. He set his church up forever. He set up the order of his ministry. He set up areas of discernment. But Revelation is working on two witnesses, church and state. That's why it starts out with the church throughout its years of history, symbolic patterns. Then it works on all the panorama of history from yesterday to tomorrow, and it cuts back and forth. And some of these things overlap. Trumpets overlap, seals overlap, but the significance of this is based on a very short and empowering concentration of spiritual force and its reaction just before the unveiling of the trumpet. Now, a lot of these things are already happening, and a lot of these processes are even take place over and over. We'll get into this when we're working on Revelation just by itself. Other questions? Well, the Sabbath never really was Saturday. You see, in the ideas that God created the earth in 6 days, and the seventh day he rested, these were sabbatical cycles of many, many, many ages. This is the recreation anyhow, and these are cycles. But because they say God rested, it was this period that he ceased from the work of building the area of environment. But he didn't cease from producing life, because it was on the seventh day while God was resting. And he said, there are no white men, there are no Adamites now down here on the earth, even in this reconstruction. So therefore, he brought forth Adam as his own issue in that seventh day. But he didn't consider this toil. So now, later on, we are told that after man had fallen and work came upon him and so forth, they were told that they should rest one day in seven from their toil and their labors. Now, this wasn't just, this was for their own physical good. They needed the cycle of rest of the breaking of the pace. And so, therefore, in this period of time, they had freedom, and they worshiped God. It was a day in which the Adamite enjoyed himself, and always they never broke the cycle of worship. And even if they were away from the center of the congregations that were early forming, well, they broke time to worship with us wherever they were on the seventh day. Now, you couldn't start a measure year one and come down, say, every seventh day. Now, this only transpired until the day when, after this, remember, all kinds of things happened, catastrophes and even the changing of the cycles of the sky and so forth. Now, when Venus came into our solar system, and after the Exodus, when God gave to Moses the laws, he said that after the crossing of the moon at the vernal equinox, that every day thereafter was to be a Sabbath for them, or a rest period, until the seventh day, which was to be a Sabbath, and every seventh day thereafter was to be their Sabbath for them throughout the year. So this meant that the moon might cross the vernal equinox, it might cross on Wednesday. All right, so then every Wednesday would be the Sabbath for that year, and all these days in between that and the equinox was the Sabbath for them, was a vacation of 7 days, and therefore a Sabbath from any heavy work or any of these things. Now, and they did worship this. Then every seventh day thereafter was a Sabbath. Now, there was not too much trouble. This was they set the Sabbath by the moons and the times and the seasons. And this was the Mosaic Sabbath of the. It wasn't a Sabbath. Wasn't a creative Sabbath. Nobody had a creative Sabbath record anymore. But they had a Mosaic Sabbath, and the big thing was that they set aside one day in seven to rest and worship. Now, the Jews, when they came in and plagued the courts of Rehoboam and so forth, they were disturbed and distressed by the fact that their businesses had to alter and that they had to close on these various days. It upset their problems. So they got together and they influenced the the Rehoboam and these others, and they decided that they would, instead of setting the Sabbath up as God told them to do, well, these kikes set Sabbath up on Saturday. But they didn't call it Saturday then, but it was the seventh day of the week. Now, under the Roman calendar, the Roman calendar named the days after various mythological figures. Thus, the first day of the week was Sunday, then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and each one of these were various gods, like Thor and so forth. So in this instance, the Jews, which by now had come in into Jerusalem and Palestine in the days of Jesus, this mixed multitude that Christ said were their father, the devil, and were Amalekites, Hittites, and Canaanites. We can prove this by Jesus' identification of them. They had in the Sanhedrin, and back even before the Maccabean time, they were setting up a Saturday Sabbath. And the Essene company were setting up the time with accuracy based on the days and weeks and the measures of the moon. Well, this is why when Jesus' disciples walked along the road and they plucked corn, and these Jews wanted to stone Jesus' disciples, and they wanted to get everybody mad. They said, look here, he breaks the law. See, his disciples plucked corn on the Sabbath day. Jesus said, look ye to it. Ye serve times and seasons you don't know anything about. Who says this is the Sabbath day anyhow? He said, in the first place, the week that in Christ's ministry that they said this, it was Wednesday, was the Sabbath instead of Saturday. And Jesus pinned this onto them, that they had changed the Sabbath for their own convenience. Now Jesus said, let me tell you something. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for him to rest, not for him to starve because he couldn't stop and pick an ear of corn. It's really no work to pick an ear of corn and eat it, or an apple, you know. It isn't like they went out and gathered sacks of corn to sell it on the market. They just stopped to get some corn to eat. And Jesus said, after all, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. We've got a lot of Puritans that, well, they mean well, they would make Sabbath such a day of bondage that they couldn't smile at or enjoy themselves, you see. In fact, they hardly could go to some churches if they heard the truth, you know, because they might enjoy it. But anyhow, some people try to make themselves miserable on the Sabbath. Well, God didn't set the Sabbath up to make men miserable. You know, when I was a little boy, I kind of liked Saturday much better than Sunday, because while I didn't mind going to Sunday school, I didn't mind going to church. I didn't like to be curbed, as they curbed us in New England, from doing anything I wanted to do on the Sabbath day. See? I figured after that, well, I just never felt that there was any difference after that in this day and any other day. and yet you just had to kind of sit around and be real quiet and look at pictures and books and read. And then they even stuck the funny seats away till the next day, you know, that kind of thing. But, well, this was, I'm not condemning the pattern that this was according to what was considered to be the acceptable standard. But there wasn't anything about this in the Bible. We were like, somewhat like the Pharisees at that time. We had set up more traditions on this matter. And the fact is that people sometimes take too lightly the areas of their responsibility to worship. This they should do. But at the same time, that God did not put a bondage upon people that they couldn't do anything. They just had to sit down and wait for Monday, see. But so this is the... So when you say, when did they change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday? Well, in the first place, Jesus had already proved to them that this Saturday wasn't the Sabbath day anyhow. It just might by chance come up sometime, but it wasn't. So when Christ resurrected, he resurrected on the first day of the week. And the Christians now were inspired to assemble on the first day of the week, because this was a new Sabbath unto them. It was the Lord's day. It was the day of his resurrection. So all through the New Testament, they might have assembled on Saturday if everybody had the shops closed. Well, they might sit around and talk and have a picnic and preach and so forth. But the moment the Lord's day came, the Christians worshiped. And it says, and they brought in their tithes as God had blessed them and had set in store, that they might fulfill their responsibilities, and they would break the communion. And then they many times ate and lunched together, and then as Christian churches were set up everywhere, they always got together on the first day of the week. And so this was known as an unrestrictive Sabbath. In other words, this was we assembled on this day to worship Christ, and as such, this was a day of freedom, This was a man was not bound down. The early Christians wouldn't do anything on Sunday except worship or feel free. They didn't work. Then the early church had quite a few arguments. The Nicene Fathers even got in quite a discussion over this. So they said that there might be certain areas of responsibility that some people might have to do some things on the Sabbath while others worship, but that all men should have at least one day in seven in which they would be free, in which they would have had time to relax, to improve their minds, to do as they wish, and that if they couldn't worship on the Lord's Day, that they should take some time out for worship. But that if people didn't assemble themselves together to worship, that even though they understood or they learned or they thought, they didn't get the catalyst of energy that a lot of people, or even two or three or four, five, ten, gathered together in my name. This is why families should meditate together. This is why congregations should come together, because the catalyst will leave a much clearer impulse. This is a part of our cultural heritage. This is a part of our racial destiny. This is why if we had a nigger in here, he wouldn't help us any. He might get something out of it, but I'll tell you why he wouldn't help us any. His vibrations would not be conformable to this, and he would just be like a dead stone. He'd be dragging. If you had 10 of them in here, we'd have to open the windows anyhow. But the thing is, this is the reason why, again, that we were told that we're not to assemble with the strangers, see? They weren't strangers, couldn't even come to the temple when they worshiped. They had to go in their own court, because there are some things that some people don't perceive, but they're no less real. The vibratory impact, the area of aura, the energy of the thought waves make up an area of environment. You can just feel it like a thick cloud you could cut with a knife when you walk down through Spring Street or Hill Street some days. And then you can get out sometimes in other parts of the city and everything is free and fresh. And I mean, a big city, you see this more. We don't have as much problem out here because the sprinklings of the invasion are not as heavy, see. But you take a tent city with all the millions of people, and then you get a high build-up of the enemy. So maybe they're 30% of the population. And you know that the vibratory impact there, just of their sordidness, their lack of spirit, makes an environment that the spiritually enlightened can feel. My, how glad it is to get out in the fresh air, see. And this is true. Someone says, well, why don't you tell everybody to get out of the city? Because they won't do it, and besides, it's closer to their work, so I don't tell them to get out of the city. But I'd get out, see. I wouldn't live on that side of the mountain for it. Another question?
In addition to the Ten Commandments, what are the other laws that the Israelites are supposed to obey?
Well, the Ten Commandments were basic cultural code. And these are very important standpoints. Now, everything that God unveiled to Moses, and you don't think he was up there all that time just telling him what was on the Ten Commandments. Those Ten Commandments were a covenant in stone of the basic requirements, the key points of the preservation of society, like thou shalt not commit adultery. The word is thou shalt not cohabit with another race. This is what it says. See? Not that there wasn't ample discussion later in all the areas of the moral code, of the codes of ethics related to the relationship of Israelite with Israelite, or there were not descriptions concerning areas of agriculture, or even areas of food and diet and of economy. All these things are given to Moses, and he has them, and they're codified in Leviticus and so forth. Now, so these things were made known, and Moses came down and wrote them all down. This is what God said. This is what they were to perform. Now, there were some places, if you do as I tell you, you get all these blessings. And if you don't do it, this is what's going to happen. And this is just what the law is going to make happen, because it's the energies you set in motion, it's the things that it does. I don't have to come down and do it. Of course, God said, if the enemy comes in and gets into this picture, I'll help a little. I'll send storms. I'll do these things. But God also teaches another law, which we'll discuss some night. This is the vibratory law that relates to the energies and impact of the consciousness of man on even the forces of nature. And this is why God has to put spiritual shields and fields around his people to protect them from the devastation that might be done by the disobedience of whole areas of society which bring these things down upon themselves. So you can remember this when the earth's shaking. Another question?
Do you know more about this earthquake pattern?
Yeah, I know some things about it.
You started mentioning it, but then you
No, I don't think I'm going to talk about it tonight. We have a 300-mile wide pattern starting tomorrow. It is in little wanes about 8. Then picks up another cycle a little farther on. But this is so wide that it would be as wide as the Andes and wider. It would reach way out into Arizona, and it would reach out into the ocean. But it's not. Now, don't think for a moment that this thing couldn't be cocked enough that a 300-mile band might start it moving, and then you could get one. But now, the place to most look for, if you get a big wide band like this, it's generally the ocean faults that move on the ocean side, because this is where wide band pressure has its biggest effect. Because whereas alignments of transiting faults or contact faults will move sometimes, it's the fault that's only within a fraction of 1, 2, 3 degrees, comes down maybe within an area that you can say, well, California is just going to get it by itself, or it's going to hit right in Alaska or maybe in the Andes. This is spread out enough. Now, here's what they're worried about. There is no doubt that the shelf fault is cocked. There's no doubt that if you get a major underwater earthquake, if you can get a tidal wave with such proportions that it could climb right up off over the Pacific Palisades and right up over Santa Monica and slosh its way almost all the way to City Hall, say. If you got it big enough, and if you got subsidence with it, which could accompany it. Now, one of these days, the whole coastal shelf is going to have whole parts of it drop out, and only with ribs of it will be left. And this judgment is going to come upon areas of the city of Los Angeles. It's going to come upon areas of the coastal plain. I don't tell this because we like to, but because it is going to happen. And only a miracle could stop it, and that miracle doesn't look like it's forthcoming. That whole city isn't going to turn to a total appeal to the Most High to stay off this judgment. Because they won't even believe you. And it is going to happen. Now, there are areas of this measure, and we have between June and July of this year, in the end of June and into July, another relatively broad cycle with high pinpoints, which could be a major impact along our west coast. And then it could happen next June and July, because it just happens that there are many seismologists who are saying that if it don't happen this June to July, it's going to happen next one. But I see a much more deadly point at the 30th of May this year. The alignments are the heaviest since the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens, the 30th of May. Oh, yeah. Well, they can affect other things too, but these alignments are going to be in position for a possible toss-up. Well, it could be. He'll cry, oi, 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 to the heavens. Again, we're not telling you it's going to get. I'll know more before this. I will very carefully pinpoint this impact. There were so many this year, and there's so much this year and next year. It's so scattered out that a person could spend the whole 6 months of the year, spend every other day just working on these points. And there was just too much. Some years only 4 or 5 points all year long. Like the earthquake in March last year, these things on up into December and the kind of patterns. But this is the rest of the year. Another question? Well, a lot of people eat a lot of ham, and this is not good. Not so much the wood isn't that important. No, it isn't going to stop you having eternal life, but it's going to stop you having it in this body, probably, because the stuff will kill you. I mean, people say, oh, my, good food's all right. We've inspected it. Sure, you just inspected it. The worms are still there. I mean, it still carries things that you can't digest, and it still carries factors. Now, there any doctor that has made any clinical tests on anybody running a cancer test, anybody who has had fresh pork, 1 week from the time they've had fresh pork, you can get a positive cancer test as long as any of that remains even in the bowel tract, which proves that the juices of fresh pork have the same reaction. Now, the reason for this is that this is a filthy piece of meat because this was not made for consumption. It's a mutation of species. I don't want to get into the subject tonight, but I'll tell you about this. Whereas the whole inside of a hog is almost exactly like that of a man, set up perfectly, except for the four-legged mutation. But all of the poisons drain through the meat of pork and eventually come out of little holes down here back of the heels. Most people don't know this, but these two little holes, you look at the hog, and you'll see a green fluffy-like material right down here on the feet of a hog, right? Right down here, and there's a hole there, a drain hole. Now, all the poisons, the most vicious poisons, the virulent toxic ones that carry the contamination, the disease patterns, the viruses, move out through this route. Now then, so someone said, oh, I like pork, it's a succulent meat. Sure, you're drinking all that drainage and pus and germs, and it's all juicy, isn't it, see? And that's why you get this cancer reaction, see? Now, so this is the, someone says, well, I just eat it because the Jews don't. Don't fool yourself. The Jews are pork eaters. They ritually say no, but they are heavy consumers of it. See? And everywhere where they go out, whether it was not with somebody else to eat it, and the highest consumption of it, in fact, the Jews got in the meatpacking business, and they produce all kinds of sausages, and they run the pork into it all, see? Except where they have, you see something, well, this is kosher, this is pure beef, see? But the fact is that that's relatively true. But at the same time, only ceremonial foods do they keep clean the rest of the time. Now, I'll prove this to you. There is practically no known cancer today among Arabs, except those that smoke the hoodah. Now, Arabs, under the law of Mohammed, who strictly followed the laws of Moses and interpreted even what was involved in some of these things rather clearly without anybody trying to mess it up, he would not permit them to take narcotics. They couldn't use any form of tobacco. They could not use any strong liquor. And they could eat no hog. And you don't find a Mohammedan.